our topic is maintaining self-respect and respect for others. And it's a really deeply fundamental subject. From time to time, over my own spiritual journey with Baba, which has lasted about 25 years now. You okay down in the Spanish group? Is it coming through now? Do you have translation? From time to time, during my own journey, there have been periods where I've run into some difficulties, some obstacles, and always, I would say, just about invariably, when I've spoken to one of the seniors about this, they've said, you need to maintain your self-respect. It's that fundamental. I think probably for most of us, you may know that a few years ago I had the privilege of interviewing Daddy for a book which came to be called Inside Out. And it's a real gem. It's based on a series of interviews where the title came from a common thread that emerged from these interviews, which was that Daddy bases her life on the ability to come from inside to out and not to let the outside go in a negative way. So inside, all of us, as children of Baba, all of us have that potential to be radiant. And with the knowledge that he gives, we actually can be like this constantly. It's possible. Daddy shows it. You know, she shows that it's possible. She's done it by being very attentive to her thoughts and feelings all her life, and to understanding that that power comes from a connection with God, from knowing God truly. If that link is maintained, the link with truth, the battery stays charged, the battery, which you could say is of self-respect or it's of love and understanding. And because there's that charge in the battery, it's like a force field that is around Daddy, so that she's able to let any negative influences that come at her just deflect them like water off a duck's back, as we say in English, so that things don't penetrate. And by maintaining that strength, where she's constantly, the essence of it is that it's a constant outflow of positivity, that is in itself a gift to the negativity. It can be a light that switches off the darkness, removes the darkness that has given rise to the negativity. So it's not only something very powerful for protecting the self and for maintaining the self-respect, but in doing that, automatically, we are becoming bestowers. We're able to radiate an energy which is of benefit to other people. So every time I get upset about something, it was often Daddy who I'd be seeing over the years in London, and she would say, "It's a lack of self-respect, Neville. I keep telling you, it's a lack of self-respect." You should take care of your self-respect. And I would see that that was true, but in some way I'd allowed myself to be deflated by a circumstance or my own behavior in some way or something someone had said. But with such sand scars arising from 2,500 years of body consciousness, that even though this is the common answer to our problems, but still we know it's quite a job to get our self-respect back in order, making it strong again. And one of the first things that is perhaps not so very obvious, but which is something that I like very much for maintaining self-respect, is the loving thought that when I'm lacking in self-respect, that in itself is a cause for self-respect. You can think of it this way, because the lack of self-respect comes from the fact that I'm a very old soul, I have known that deity status, I've been a part of that world of perfection and happiness, where the need for spiritual skills of relating with one another wasn't there, it was just paradise for all that time. And so that was my experience for half the Kalpa, and then for so long, subsequent to that experience of paradise, I've experienced that phase in the drama where state of perfection wasn't present, and so not surprisingly I've developed a lack of self-respect because I didn't have the strength as time went on to cope with the copper and iron ages adequately. I didn't keep that power of positivity, partly because, as Buddha explains, we're old souls who have had that long journey. So in itself, the very fact that there is this lack of self-respect can be reinterpreted as a point for self-respect. But of course, you have to then act on it so that you remove the source of the lack of self-respect. But as a starter, it's a really good thing, because you know when this lack of self-respect hits us, it's very disabling. And we need antidotes that will give us the power to start the ball rolling in a more positive way again. And this is a good one. It's connected to what Baba often tells us, you know, to understand that this is Kali Yuga, I've had this enormous journey, 63 births in an imperfect world, and within the drama that it was in everybody's part to be kind, even the greatest souls. Certainly he tells us all of the deities and the religious founders who came with such strength, they too, over the centuries, have lost their power. So it's no surprise that I find myself here at the end of the Kalpa with these defects that trouble me. So the first thing is to say, okay, it's there. Let me realize that it's there because I was a deity. I was in that state of perfection previously. That's why, not surprisingly, I feel bad about myself sometimes today. It is also good to protect us, to have that kind of nimbleness of intellect. It's also good to protect us from the trap that Batbada mentioned in a recent Avyek Murli. Remember, he said that sometimes the children maintain self-respect in a false way. I forget exactly the expression he used, but he said that we use the titles in our heads. You know, that I am this, I am a former deity, I am a great soul. Sometimes this just stays in the head. And it becomes actually an obstacle to our restoring ourselves, because if I'm making myself contented on the basis of a false support, just something that is not really being implemented in my life, but is just an intellectual idea that comforts me temporarily, then that's not actually going to help me in the long run. It's going to be like a bandage that will cover up the wound, but the wound will not heal so fast, actually. So I don't want to fall into that trap either. So this is a good first step to realize that it's not surprising that this lack of self-respect is there. And that's a gift to the self. And we need to give to ourselves. Buddha's giving to us, but he gives to everybody. He says, you know, I'm not putting any limits on what I'm giving. And so we have to receive those gifts and work with them. We have to have the guts to do that. We have to have the courage to do that. The sooner we develop the courage to do that, the quicker we will recover our state of perfection, our self-respect, our ability to act with love and respect towards others, our ability to succeed in the world in a genuine way, not in artificial ways that our ego developed over the centuries. Just while on this point, I remember I was travelling with Sister Manda in the UK a few weeks ago, and it was quite a long journey, and Manda sat doing some calculation of how many minutes of body consciousness we've all experienced. I think the number she came up with was something like nearly 1.5 billion minutes of body consciousness. That's the number of minutes in half a kalpa. She just worked this out, you know, because, and it's a nice thing, because to realize that we've had that history, you know, where we've lived in this splintered world where we were all on our own, and we'd lost the father and the inheritance of the father. We were orphans, and we had to find other ways of surviving in that splintered world. And so we've had all that time in which we were developing these habits of maintaining self-respect in wrong ways, basically feeding the ego in these different ways. So all those billions of minutes of body consciousness. But we also are thinking that even though that long experience of body consciousness, obviously, it's going to take some work to shift it, so we have to expect that and not be surprised when as we move along the journey, that we fail from time to time. But also, we can see that for the other half of the kalpa, that first half, we've had, whatever it would be, 1,400,000,000 minutes of soul consciousness, of pure consciousness. So that's lying there within the soul's experience as well. So we just have to kind of shift our way of thinking into a satyogi way. I think it was Daddy Janki who said not so long ago that one of the greatest renunciations is to make our focus the Golden Age, Satyug. To make that what is filling our intellect. To really, really make the jump. But what I'm working for is Satyugi consciousness. I know that this old world has a little time longer to run, and I've responsibilities and relationships that I'm still living through here in this old world, but behind what I do on the surface, everything to be for Satyug, that golden aged world where irritation, violence, greed, lust, attachment, they're unthinkable. They just don't exist. They're not a part of that world. It's a beautiful reminder. We may not do it often enough. I remember some few years back, I came with my ex-wife to Madaban, Liz Hodgkinson. She's also a writer and a journalist like myself. And she'd come to do some research for the book Peace and Purity, which is the story of the BKs. And I accompanied her. She hadn't been to Madaban for many years. And I accompanied her on some interviews with seniors and long-standing students. And one of the most remarkable was with Lachi Daddy. Do you all know Lachi Daddy? She's a shortish sister. She's one of the founding sisters, right through the Yagya years. You don't hear her giving classes, like with Holy Daddy, who left her body recently and who Daddy Janki had endless praise for. We didn't see her. In my 25 years of coming here, I'd hardly had a conversation with Holy Daddy, but what an achievement that soul went with and quietly had done that. Similarly with Lucky Daddy, you do see her. She appears when Baghdada comes. You see her bringing out the borg tray and putting the cloth on, doing everything very neatly, very quietly, and then quietly disappearing. Just does that job with complete quietness, not looking for anything. Her role has been, actually, in the earlier Yantya years, it was looking after the stores. I think she still does this to some extent. Things like toothpaste and soap. When Madaban Nawasis needs something, she'll be the one who provides it, and she keeps a tally to make sure that it's not being wasted. Quiet little job. And Liz asked her, you've spent, you know, your life, almost all your life, doing these simple things. Don't you feel that it would have been wonderful to have experienced nice clothes and eating out and, you know, the cinema, things like this, and a glass of wine? And Lachi Daddy was uncomprehending that such a question could be asked. She said, but every minute of my life, I'm constructing my future. Every minute of my life, I'm giving another, you know, more strength to my time in all those births in paradise. How could that compare with that? And it really was, it was as if she couldn't understand where Liz was coming from in the slightest. She has such self-respect that her life is of the greatest. And these characters are sometimes, you know, not at all obvious, but they're very good examples. I've been doing some more interviews with Daddy Janki, for a new book on this trip. And I mentioned last night, very briefly, some of you may have been at the gathering with Daddy last night, that something that had come home to me in a more powerful way than ever was the total dedication required for success, for real success in this Brahmin journey. You can do BK light options, as we sometimes call it laughingly, you know, like a light beer or something like that. BK light, you know, you can compromise here and there, and all of us will do, no doubt. I mean, otherwise we'd all be karmatite immediately, in a sense. But what Daddy had brought home to me with a series of stories, because this next book is structured around some stories from her memories of her journey. Again and again, there were stories of total love and surrender. Total love and surrender. And I mentioned last night that I've always loved the totality with which Daddy describes this journey. You know, no room for compromises, no tactful, you know, of course she's very careful with each one of us as individuals to advise us appropriately, because it is a journey. But basically, always her classes are about truth. No compromise. And she is urging us to go with her up and over the hill to Satyug with that total effort, as much as we can muster. And she wants it to be 100% from us. And she keeps saying, you can do it now. It's just a question of a decision at some point. Make it now. And these stories are challenging to me, because I suppose on my own journey, although the heart recognized in a very deep and powerful way right from the beginning what I was dealing with, truth, in this family, in this organization, because when I met just some junior BKs, I felt a quality that was missing inside me very much. And when I met people like Sister Genty and Sudesh Ben and Daddy Janky in London, I felt that there is no greater service to the world than to be like these people are. And I wanted to become like them. And yet at that time, I remember also having the feeling, even though Daddy says that the arrow had been shot, that she had shot it, Didi Manmohini, she had come to London a few months before I came into Gyan, and she happened to be staying in a little house quite just a couple of miles from where I was living. I knew nothing about it, but Daddy always says that in some subtle way, you know, when our journeys start, the memory comes back to us when those with whom we're connected in this great fabric of the Brahmin family, when they come and their truth calls us. It doesn't even have to be in words, but it doesn't even have to be with an immediate physical presence, but it can sometimes just be a vibration. And Daddy Janky says Didi pulled me in some way, and it was just soon after that I came into contact with the BKs. And the arrow penetrated my heart, but my head was filled with scientific, materialistic ideas. I've lived in quite a materialistic way. I've done no heart-acty, if you like, in this birth. I had a kind of distaste for that sort of thing. And so my head was very slow to accept that this was the way I was describing things was really as it was. So my heart was ready to give itself. And it did, in a way. It did. Because the head has provided plenty of problems along the way, which it still hasn't managed to take me away from Baba, because the heart was there and was held. But the head has given problems. Sometimes I've thought of it as being a kind of value, where perhaps because of some past experiences in past births, I've given away my intellect to something and then it didn't turn out to be worth giving oneself to, you know, like that image of giving yourself to something that seems wonderful, takes you halfway across the river, and then you drown because it wasn't the real thing, but that wanting to give myself to something. And so great caution in the intellect. But a more straightforward way of looking at it was what Daddy Janki mentioned during these interviews, because I commented to her at one point, here are these souls who she was describing their stories to me, who in some way they were able to give themselves immediately and wholeheartedly, to the point that they didn't have questions, and to the point that they might give their lives for this, and they didn't have questions. These were the stories that he was highlighting. There were also others who had fallen by the wayside. You know, it's a tough journey. And so I tell you one or two of these stories just in outline as well. But I said to Daddy, I was pulled by my heart, and she said, yes, it was within the drama that Dee hooked you. And I said, Daddy, why did it take me all these years before my intellect would accept the truth of Brother's knowledge? Because it did. I feel as if it's only in recent years that it's really penetrated the reality that I am a soul, that I am a child of God, that I'm an actor in this play, that the play is drawing to a close. I liked the idea. It had a certain beauty, but I questioned it. You know, it wasn't always rock solid. Other things would pull me away from the conviction that this was true. So I said, why did you take me so long, Daddy? Just you can say it in just a few words. She said, it was ego. It didn't take many words. At least I'm happy that I think that's the first time that Daddy has directly stated it's your ego. And, you know, as with all these things, it's a measure of my advance in my self-respect, I feel, so I'm happy to hear that from Daddy. Because, you know, we can be buttered up and we can tell one another that we're this and we're that. And often when we come to Baba, because of the wounds caused by our ego, like it says in the Pandavavan dining room, ego is the root of all suffering. So our egos have caused us suffering. And when we're still hurt and inflamed, or we've got barriers around ourselves because of that suffering, we don't like to hear that we have this ego. But no, I don't mind hearing about that. I'd be happy to hear more about that, actually, from Daddy and the seniors. I don't mind now. And because my self-respect is more in place. And that's because not only my heart, but my head have got this, it's penetrated inside now. Mind and intellect. That's what we need, actually, essentially. Mind and intellect, both receiving constantly, both with USB lines, whatever it would be, you know, like into a computer, both constantly connected to Baba's mind and Baba's thinking. That means Baba's feeling and Baba's thinking. Okay, Baba doesn't think and he doesn't feel in one sense, but only when what's potential within him expresses itself through the material world. But through Brahma Baba we saw what was in Shiv Baba, and it was total self-respect, total love, total respect for others, total acceptance of the drama, total power. That is Shiv Baba's mind and intellect, if you like, as we see it expressed through Brahma Baba. And that's what actually restores our self-respect, to the extent that we really make Shiv Baba's mind and intellect ours, as we can see it the way Brahma Baba showed it. One realization that I've had recently was that there are two types of bhakti. One is bhakti, is heart bhakti, or almost a kind of physical love bhakti. And one is intellect bhakti. So one is, in a sense, mind bhakti, and one is intellect bhakti. I didn't realize this before. I just thought of bhakti as, you know, it's usually translated as devotional feelings. On a recent trip to the south of India, which is the home of bhakti, actually, bhakti is immensely strong in southern India. Very beautiful bhakti in a way that has, you know, sustenance to a degree of the quality of life for the people there over the centuries. A kind of bhakti that Baba says eventually he comes and gives the fruit for us. It's like a quality bhakti. And I saw down there, yes, there was a beautiful bhakti of wonderful old temples, fantastic priests, you know, these with beautiful bodies, really beautiful bodies. They come from a caste that deliberately and very carefully takes care of these bodies through hatha yoga, through care in diet. The climate is lovely, so they just have sort of light clothes that they wear. And they're sitting around the temple, and they're very contented, they're very courteous to visitors, they're very lovely, and loving actually. They were really kind and informative. And it's a caste thing actually, it's something that has gone down over centuries through families where this role is played out. And I saw that they just accept a certain way of thinking and living, and they don't think beyond that about it. So it's not a jnani bhakti. It hasn't got jnana in it. And in the end, if things get rough, it will let you down, that kind of bhakti. Because in a sense, it's body-based. It's a body-conscious type of devotional behavior. But it's rather lovely. So it's a kind of high level of example of heart bhakti. But then, the other side, I was attending the Indian Science Congress, and actually, this is the big gathering of scientists from across India, an annual gathering in Chidambaram, about 5 hours' drive from Chennai. And held at a university there, Annamalai University. This was also a fascinating experience. It brought home to me something quite different. Firstly, I half expected, because I have so much respect for India and its culture, and I'd thought that Indian science would be ahead of Western science in knowing that science is not enough, you know. Science is very good at describing the physical world and mastering matter in various ways, but it's only good in the physical dimension, and the sort of more philosophical or spiritual things I thought would still be present in a gathering of scientists in India, but there wasn't, not a bit of it. Even less than in Western science gatherings, actually. Nowadays, in the West, there's an awakening to an understanding that just focusing on the physical material dimension isn't enough. That it's not dominant in science yet, of course, because science has built its success on its focus on material laws. But it is growing, and at the equivalent annual meeting of British scientists, for example, you would definitely find some fringe meetings about consciousness studies, about the possibility of non-locality of mind, you know, an expression that the scientists use when they're looking at the possibility that there may be more to mind than just the brain. They are studying these issues. It's not mainstream yet, but it's there. It's a very encouraging development. But it was not at all present in the Indian science gathering. What was there was very much a focus on laser technology, satellite technology, computer technology, agrochemicals, various aspects of trying to make life better in physical ways. And this is still where Indian science is coming from after some decades of India suffering a lot of poverty, you know, in the wake of colonization and then various models of government that didn't work very well subsequently, and now economic growth coming through and science fueling a lot of the increased prosperity that's happening now for India. So there's a great attention to this. But because it was at a university, I was taken to meet some people who were hosting the event, but who were not necessarily part of the science gathering. And one of these who I found really interesting to meet was a professor of anatomy at the university who was also an expert on the ancient scriptures of India, the Vedas. And he kind of gave me and a sister that took me to meet him a two-hour lecture on the wisdom of these ancient scriptures. And he was actually quite dismissive about the science gathering, even though he's a scientist himself, but he's saying, that's all rubbish. It's all rubbish. It just fills your head with rubbish so that you can't know the truth. He would say this, but as he went on, I realized that in another way that I'd not understood previously, he was also blocking out the truth as we know it through Baba with all his wonderful knowledge of the Vedas. It's a surprising thing. He spoke brilliantly about these ancient truths, wonderful quotes, great wisdom present within those scriptures. And it is wisdom. I only know that it's wisdom because of what I've learned from Baba. You know, the right way to live, the illusory nature of fame and position, all of these sort of things, how we have to remove the negative emotions and comparisons and jealousies, all of those, the way they'll get in the way of the truth, all of that is there in those stories and scriptures. But he knew it all as up in his head. It was as if there was a great web of this knowledge in his head that was actually stopping him too from experiencing the simplicity of the truth of the soul as Baba has introduced us to ourselves through him. Wonderful, amazing realization for me, because I think in the past I've sort of put the intellect, because I suppose partly because of working with my intellect a lot and putting a lot of faith in the intellect for the future through science to try and sort out the world's problems with the human intellect, you know. This was my own bhakti in the past, that the intellect would see the way through and the heart should be disregarded. It led us into so many problems. So this was a realization for me that we can easily intellectualize wisdom, and it still won't become truth, as Baba introduces himself. This is where Daddy Janki is so wonderful, because she says that she's so grateful that she just had 3 years of formal education. Didn't fill her head with these things. It can include values, you know, it can include all sorts of social expectations, social conditioning, which may have been useful to us through our lives. These can sometimes be very good things, family values, social values, other things, that we may feel quite proud that we've got these inside us, but they too can be blocks to the truth, the whole truth, getting that whole truth inside ourselves. They really can. Even very good things can be blocks. And this is why it's a subtle matter to realize where our self-respect may be maintained by things that are still not the real thing. They're still false supports, ultimately. And we need to try to get rid of these while there's still time. Because it's very clear from Baba's original inspirations and visions, what Brahma Baba was shown by Shiv Baba, that, you know, everything is going to collapse. We don't know precisely when. We know that world authorities are telling us that environmentally there are such threats, and we know that socially and in terms of family and quality of life in so many different parts of the world, it's deteriorating and things are getting tougher. You know, another little secret along these lines that I heard from some Madhavan Nawasis, they were telling me that even the animals here in Mount Abu are becoming distressed. It's amazing. Actually, it's known to the authorities, and the conservation authorities provoked a reaction in the people of Abu a little while back by proposing to make the whole of this area a conservation area, which would cut down a lot on visitors and this sort of thing. But the animal community is becoming distressed because there's so much noise, you know, there's frequent fireworks, there are big speakers that can make noise into the night, and the animals don't like this. It's penetrating their habitat in ways that are stopping them from living their truth as well. There's a mad monkey in Madhavan at the moment. Had to watch out for him. He's not... I saw him. I was in Pandavavan courtyard, and he came bounding through. Big chap. And he came within a whisker of me, actually. I was just standing talking to someone. He came whisking past. I could almost feel the wind from him. And he did a big leap from that parapet beside Nivebhai's room onto a chair that was standing there, and onto the back of one of those yellow chairs. The chair fell over, but he just bounded on. And someone told me that this fella, he'll sometimes clout people as he's coming through. He's a sign of the times. I've never seen a monkey behave so badly before. They used to come and pinch our bananas and things like that, but they do it with less aggression than this chap had. So we know, all of us know from the state of the world around us, how this decline is accelerating, and whether it's 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we know that whatever false supports we're still using to maintain our self-respect, the sooner we can get rid of them and substitute the total truth about ourselves that Baba is inviting us to take on board, the stronger we'll be for supporting ourselves, maintaining our strength and contentment through these difficult times ahead, and being a beacon of light for others. Wonderful image for us to make this our goal. I really, really deeply accept this in my heart now, that this is what I want to be. I fought it in a way for many years, but I really want this. When I started interviewing Daddy about this new book some while back, it didn't take shape for a while, but one thing that inspired me was she said she's looking in all her travels across the world for she used this expression, beacons of light. People who can be so illuminated that they, whatever is happening doesn't damage their self-respect or their ability to give respect and love to others, so that they're radiant. It's like that lighthouse image also that Denise Ben was talking about yesterday. And it is a great goal for us all. It really is worthwhile. and very manageable and achievable. When I began on this journey, that arrow penetrated my heart, and I thought, this is amazing, this Baba is so beautiful, but it's an impossible love. That expression came to my mind at that time, this is an impossible love. Somehow I knew that there were going to be obstacles within my karma that would make it difficult for me to give myself wholeheartedly to this for some time. Each one of us varies enormously in the way that we come to Baba like this. And these stories that Daddy's been telling me illustrate this. And then those who understood so clearly and so quickly that it didn't matter what obstacles came to them, as I say, even death, and they were not going to be deterred from keeping their connection with Baba. Truly, there were two or three cases, Daddy said, in the early Yajna years when the sisters who had wanted to come to Baba and their families were so violent towards them, so offended by their attempts to break free of the social constraints or the family constraints or the marital constraints, that they killed them. They actually gave their lives at that time. And you know, amazingly, I said, but Daddy, because I'm somewhat playing the role of, you know the expression, devil's advocate, and I'm interviewing Daddy, to try to, you know, take the position of a reader who wouldn't be familiar with what Daddy was meaning in these things. But I said, but Daddy, you know, can it really be right that we go on a path that would actually require us to die? You know, physically die like that? And she said, but you don't die. She said when she went to London, there was a run of young people who came and who became pillars of this Yajna. Ken, Charlie, Denise, who else? There was Waddy, Nick. There were four or five who came very... Nick was a little older, I think, but there were four or five who were about 18 or 20. And Daddy very, very clearly has the vision that these were souls who were in the Yajna, but who gave their lives for the sake of holding on to their truth, not being willing to sacrifice that truth for the sake of family values or marital anger or, you know, the social constraints. They wanted to do it, and their karma was such that they had to settle that karma painfully sometimes, maybe through severe illness and death in those early days, because a number of left their bodies because it was so tough. But they would then take rebirth. And then Daddy goes to London, and Charlie and Ken have gone to Australia. They would have been in the Yajna somewhere before. They were off in Australia, but they come travelling in Europe. Here's Daddy, they come back to the Yajna. That's the way Daddy sees it. So they don't die. Of course they don't die. You know, that's my body conscious sanskars still kind of feeling sorry for people, but the soul doesn't die. It escapes that particular circumstance, takes rebirth, and then because it has held on to the truth and settled some karma, it comes back into a wonderful role in the Yajna. This is a lovely way of thinking. It helps us to understand that old ways of thinking, you know, that, oh, but, you know, if I really do what God is asking of me, it may make me sick, or it might mean I lose my job, or, you know, these various things that will put in the way of it. But actually, why not? Why not let it make you sick? You know, if that's necessary. Of course, Baba says, don't invite sickness through stupidity. and take care of the body, feed it properly, but if it's necessary to put your health at risk for the sake of holding on to your truth and breaking through to your truth, then don't be afraid to do that. And Daddy shows us this, of course, in such a wonderful way that she's risked her life several times to maintain that truth. So just to conclude, Bubba's heart is of total, unbroken love and respect. His mind is full of such feelings as they express themselves through Brahma Bubba. Bubba's intellect is, as he shares with us every day in the Murali, he tells us what's going on. This is his way of thinking that he's telling us is the understanding that will liberate us. And with those two, when I link my mind and my intellect to wholeheartedly and whole intellectually really surrender myself in both ways to both, then I will fill with that truth and that is both the heart and the head. And my self-respect will be in question. And when I do this, I will become of such wonderful service to others. I've noticed that, and in fact, many of the stories that Daddy was speaking of, when people do this wholeheartedly, that's when others around them transform as well. Really do. And even if they don't transform, they receive a lot, for which they say from their hearts many thanks to those who have transformed. Whereas if we kind of think, well, you know, I've got to do this there and I've got that responsibility, and we let those things get in the way of the restoration of our true self-respect, which comes from restoring our truth, then those others get cheated. They don't get as much from us as if we do it in a wholehearted way, even though they may oppose. Like Daddy had so much opposition, and yet later her relatives were so respectful towards her because of what she had done for herself and was able to give to others. So that's really the nub of it, that taking everything for us in the way that Bubba's saying is the best way of showing respect to others as well as to ourselves. So I've covered quite a bit of ground in various ways. There may be some questions that have arisen. I don't know, is the brother there for us to have a handheld mic? Is anyone around? I'm not sure that they are. So if not, then if you could perhaps come and speak your question loudly, and if your voice isn't strong enough, I'll repeat it over the mic. Anyone like to ask a question arising on this subject? Is everything totally in place now in terms of self-respect? Thorsten was asking, could I say a little bit more about how losing self-respect is connected with anger? It's a question of vulnerability. I was saying at the beginning that Daddy Janki is very conscious of having developed her own self-respect to such an extent that it's like a force field that radiates from inside throughout. And as long as that force field is in place, things can come, negativities, situations, issues, circumstances, insults, and they're water off a duck's back. They just bounce off because she's got such self-respect in place through the connection with Baba's way of understanding and Baba's way of feeling. It's all dependent on that, not on what she does or what other people say or do, just on her connection with Baba, his mind and his understanding. And because she's got that so strongly in place and attends to making sure that it stays in place through the day, she does, you know, she gets them, despite how busy she is, she still ensures that she has a few minutes here and there. I've been seeing this because of doing these interviews, a few minutes here and there to remind herself of what Baba had been telling her that morning in the Murali, so that she keeps that force field in place. And then she's ready to take on everything that comes, and it doesn't penetrate her self-respect because it's intact. But if we're, as soon as we allow ourselves, allow our respect, our sense of who we are, to be dependent on anything from outside of us, you know, what we do, even what we do in good ways, what other people are saying about us, whether other people love us or not, whether we feel we've got a place in the world, you know, in that external sense, any dependency of that kind, and it's liable to, the force field of our self-respect is liable to be breached, because it's not coming from inside out, it's more like a shell that we've put around us externally. And a shell is fragile, as everyone knows. It can be penetrated by a stone or an arrow. And this shell, which is essentially an ego, where I'm maintaining my self-respect on the basis that I'm, you know, of a particular gender disposition, I'm a particular age, I come from a particular country, I have a particular financial background, I come from a particular caste, I have a particular religion, I have a particular contribution to make in the world. Any of these things are false supports, because they're actually depending on things that are external to me, and they may be maintaining me for a while, but at some point something's going to come along and penetrate that screen, and then I will hurt. And then, because that's happened countless times through the second half of the Kalpa, then I will react, and I will try to fight off that threat to me through anger, which is basically a projection. You know, I've allowed myself to be hit by a projectile that has come from outside, that has cracked my shell of ego, and so I throw something back in a way that is not from the truth of the radiance of Baba's truth, of goodness, of respect, but it's fighting it off in a negative way, like through anger, irritation, rejection. This is the connection. And I know that, you know, I've suffered from this despite receiving so much from Baba, but still my self-respect wasn't properly in place for many years, and I'm still working on it. So still things can come and can penetrate that shield, if you like, to the extent that I've still got some false things outside of me and cause me to react with anger. I'd asked Daddy about a situation that had arisen in the UK recently where I'd been given a new responsibility in relation to some property and a situation. And I was finding that this was provoking a sense of despair and frustration in me, which is kind of aspect of anger. And I couldn't shake it off. And I asked Daddy about it, and she said, you mustn't allow even issues to affect you. you know, like debates about the right thing or the wrong thing to do. It may be that the wrong thing is being done. Like bouquets. They're making mistakes. And maybe they're important mistakes. But still, you mustn't allow your self-respect to be damaged by that, even if you've been given responsibility in that area. This is a tough one. You know what it brings to mind? Ken Abiyat Baba used a wonderful expression not so long ago, that we sometimes suffer from the intoxication of duty. Very interesting expression. What he meant by that was intoxication. We sometimes use the word in the sense, in a positive way, don't we, you know, of happiness and contentment and relationship with God. But really it means, intoxication in English actually means poisoned. A toxin is a poison. And truly, really the word, normally, it would mean that you've been poisoned in some way. And intoxication of duty is when you are taking on board a duty in a body conscious way and trying to be successful in it in a way that is drawing on sanskars of force or control rather than of detachment and being truly instrumental of allowing others to deal with the situation. And I was falling victim to that. It became very clear. So there are so many different ways that we may be drawing on old ways of providing temporary solutions which just feed the ego and the shell of protection that the ego provides, but which will actually then make us vulnerable because shells break easily. That's the nature of the mechanism, I think. Is that clear? Did you have something else in mind, Thorsten? It's very interesting. You know, I've suffered from this. At one point, Daddy was telling us of this story of some sister, because there were a lot of casualties in those early years. You know, it's a miracle of how Baba's established this yagya. Those hundreds of, mainly sisters, very few brothers, survived it. And what they went through, you know, to create such a foundation that would be strong enough to weather all the storms of the decades of effort and trial and tribulation that were to follow. But anyway, yes, and many fell by the wayside, and Daddy told us at one point of some sister who had been very intoxicated in the sense of very happy to be in the yagya, and then something had happened, I think it was to do with her role, and she felt insulted. And so she left with a lot of anger. And I said, jokingly, I hope that wasn't me. And Manda translated, and Daddy laughed, and she said, when were you born? I said, February 1944. She did a quick mental calculation. It's possible. Any more questions? Yes. Yes, the sister's reminding us that very pertinent slogan from today, from the Murali, that the soul that stays in self-respect never experiences insult. Oh, and there was a sister then and the brother in front. A question about Shiv Baba. Does he or doesn't he? Right. Okay. Interesting question. The sister was saying that I'd mentioned at one point that Baba doesn't think or feel, but then I'd also said that it's good that on this journey we are making our mind like Baba's and our intellect like Baba's, and minds to do with thoughts and feelings that bubble up, and intellects have to do with how we think and understand. So does Baba think and feel or doesn't he? And her own inclination is to see him as the ocean, just that ocean of positivity, rather than as something that discriminates and, you know, goes in one direction rather than another. He's just truth. And I'm not sure that I can answer the question adequately. It's probably something that we could explore further with Daddy. But definitely I know that the way that we have asked Daddy sometimes, does Baba think? She says no. Shiv Baba doesn't think. Shiv Baba doesn't think. But the way I understand it is that because Shiv Baba is a seed, a state of total pure potential, it holds all the secrets of the drama within him, and then they gradually unfold through this, on this material stage of the world. But the process begins when that potential, that is Shiv Baba, sparks through to Brahma Baba. And Brahma Baba has got a brain and a heart and, you know, the physical organs that allow what is in that state of potential, the purest, highest potential in God, is able to be expressed and shown afresh to the world through Brahma Baba. So that's why Daddy says he doesn't distinguish actually between Shiv Baba and Brahma Baba. The way she experienced that ladder from the beginning, she says, when Shiv Baba entered Brahma Baba, was as one. This was the first time she'd been able to understand what truth really meant, and she saw it embodied in Brahma Baba. So she doesn't like to make a distinction. Of course, Brahma Baba's a human being. He has his sanskars to deal with, his karma to deal with. Shiv Baba doesn't have any negative sanskars, doesn't change in his functioning at all. But that pure truth was able to show itself because there was this chariot, Brahma Baba, which is a physical chariot. And so she, in all her searching, in her childhood and her teenage years, all her pilgrimages, she was trying to find God, right from the earliest age. And she's got all the knowledge and the wisdom and the understanding that we should behave in certain ways and that we should be giving, we shouldn't look at others' weaknesses, we should have a very pure vegetarian diet, we should do good works. All of this was deep inside her. Still she didn't know God. And she'd met Brahma Baba earlier when she was a child, but it was after Shiv Baba entered Brahma Baba that role for Shiv Baba through Brahma Baba, Shivratri, actually that taking place, what we're celebrating now, that actually taking place, then for the first time, she was able to, this is God. She'd searched so much. This is the uniqueness of the Brahma Kumaris, actually, that Brahma became vehicle for the highest to show itself to us. And this is how Baba can then say, we also become the highest and the holiest and the richest, because the highest and the holiest and the richest, which is Shiv Baba, showing itself through Brahma Baba. Brother had a question? Right. The brother's question concerns becoming the embodiment of self-respect. He was saying he didn't understand, and I'm not sure that I covered this distinction, how self-respect could be something in the head, but then with how that becomes in the heart, and also how, if we have experienced it as the embodiment, that becomes something over a long period of time. Well, I don't think self-respect is something confined to the head. It can be, nor is self-respect something confined to the heart, although it can be. My feeling is, this is what is so interesting about this path with the Brahma Kumaris, that both head and heart have to be addressed at the same time. It's like those things I was mentioning earlier about the different forms of bhakti, how some address the heart and more the, you know, that stage of self-respect that those priests have got from that special caste down in the south, and then the self-respect of the head that the professor of anatomy has got, but neither of them being really secure. Something okay, perhaps, that's kept them going, but, you know, at some point, you're going to suffer because it's not enough. And Baba's making us so solid through and through. And how is he doing that? He's doing it because, first of all, my experience was that he showed me that I am respect worthy because he showed me what it feels like to be a soul when I met the Brahma Kumaris, and that positivity, that respect that they showed to me was something I'd never seen anywhere else in the world. And I've travelled quite widely through my journalism. It was unique, and it touched my heart very deeply, and it gave me an immediate self-respect that I wanted more of. But it wasn't sustainable. In a sense, it was in my heart, it came into my body, and it aroused a memory of what it feels like to have that self-respect. But to maintain it, you've got to have gyan. You've got to really have faith. Your awareness has to change. Your deep conviction that you are an eternal soul. You know, you've got to really deeply understand that. And it means that you have to let go of all those other identities of being a good student, of being even of being a BK. You know, Daddy Janki, a few years back in London, said at one point in the gathering, she doesn't think of herself as a BK. Wonderful. I loved it so much. You know, nobody could be more committed to Brahma Kumaris. You know, she's obviously a mother's child, Brahma Kumari Janki. Absolutely, no question, but she's also beyond that. She's God's child. So not even the false support of thinking in a heady way that I'm a BK, you know, that... So my self-respect comes from that. Actually, even that would be temporary if it was just something in the head or just something through wearing a white sari or white clothes. It would still, or just, you know, following a vegetarian diet or doing certain disciplines, it would still not be real if it was just something that was external, trying to tell myself that I'm a better person. And I've made those mistakes too. Early in my years in Jian, I took a lot of intoxication from trying to be the BK externally that I wasn't internally yet. You know, we do this. So the two must go together, and it, depending which comes first, some first get this in terms of the head. They haven't sort of got too much into materialism. They've stayed connected to the spiritual understanding, like Daddy Janki, but there's something missing. That total embodiment of truth that she saw in Brahma Baba. That's what brought her to this. For me, it was something similar, really, that I saw this quality that was so missing in me and others around me, I felt, in these BKs that I met. But the understanding took time to come, and it's that understanding that's made it constant for me. Others come with the head. They've been searching a lot, and they hear this, and they say, yes, that's the last pieces of the jigsaw. This makes sense to me. They get it immediately. The faith is there in the intellect, but perhaps their heart is not as open. You know, maybe they've suffered and lived a lot in their heads, and they find it difficult to open their heart to this. So it may take time for them to really open and feel the beauty of Baba's love, the joy, the bliss of being a soul. That may take time to come. But in the end, the sustainability of it comes from having the two together. Anyway, if there's any other questions? Otherwise, I think it's time to close. Oh, one more. Right. Om Shanti.